This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Couch Potatoes, across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Going in Style, Smurfs, The Lost Village, The Void, Aftermath, and Queen of the Desert. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup with a spotlight on Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, now out on DVD and Blu-ray. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news, I have to give a fond farewell to Don Rickles, who was 90. Good show, old boy. He was 90. He passed away this week due to kidney failure, and that's a shame. And at 90, he still had, like, dates on his schedule, as I understand, to do performances. That's the way you want to go. You want to be the person who's in his 90s or at 90 who still has dates scheduled to appear and do what you love. Now, the thing that's interesting about Don Rickles is he got a bad rap, and it's funny, when I was a kid, my mom always had an issue with him because he was an insult comic. He was an early insult comic, long before it kind of became trendy, you know, long before Triumph the Insult Comic Dog. Yet Don Rickles, he was just unapologetically politically incorrect. Now, if you think that political correctness is something that started in the 80s and 90s, go back to Don Rickles. It started a long time ago because he was busting out norms and busting out taboos long before politically correct became a term. But here's why Don Rickles was above all the other comics today that just say, hey, I want to be offensive and get on the board. Don Rickles, he didn't take his shtick seriously. Being ridiculed by Don Rickles and being made fun of because of your race, because of your gender, because of your sexual orientation or anything else, or even just the way you dressed, that was a badge of honor. That's sort of the way he showed his love. And there was an interesting statement by Robert Klein that was sent out today talking about how he was just a kind and gentle man and a great guy. I mean, that was his shtick. That was his thing on stage. And nowadays, political correctness has become such a thing that people are either totally into and talking about trigger warnings and boycott things that they find just generally offensive, all the way to the other side of the coin where people want to be offensive just to be offensive. And they get offended when people get offended at what they get offended at. Don Rickles and his comedy going back to the 50s reminds us that we got to stop taking ourselves so seriously. So yeah, it's sad to see this guy go. He had quite a legacy. The next piece of news I want to talk about, it dovetails into the box office, which we'll talk about later. Ghost in the Shell did not do terribly well last week. It did about half of what they were hoping. It made like $19 million. And Paramount came out and basically said that, well, it was the controversy over casting Scarlett Johansson as a Japanese character was part of the reason the movie didn't do so well. And here's why that explanation is total horse pucky. If whitewashing caused people not to see movies, there's a lot of movies that people would not have seen over the years. I mean, look at Doctor Strange. People complained about the whitewashing of the Ancients character in Doctor Strange. Still one of the biggest hits of last fall. Or Iron Man 3, which was a huge hit. In fact, the biggest selling Iron Man movie, and the Mandarin was a whitewashed character and had an explanation within the story, but there was something that was a whitewashed character as well, over an incredibly racist Asian character. Movies like Aloha, where Emma Stone played a native Hawaiian, or Pan, in which Mara Rooney played Tiger Lily from Peter Pan, those didn't bomb because of whitewashing. They bombed because they just didn't connect with an audience. I mean, I know that Ghost in the Shell was hopefully going to do well with fanboys and anime fans. And yeah, those are the people that took it the hardest because they said, hey, you're changing the structure of the story. You're making an authentically Japanese character, not Japanese. But that was a small demographic. They were hoping to make a lot more money than what they would get off of these people. You got to remember the first Ghost in the Shell, when it came out in 1996, it made $500,000 in the U.S. box office. Whether you're talking today's numbers or whether you're talking 1996 numbers, that was a terrible box office. It didn't hardly reach the mainstream. I think most people have never heard of Ghost in the Shell, let alone seen it. It was a stretch for a mainstream story, and we talked about this last week, and even though they tempered the story and changed it for an American mainstream audience, essentially it's a hard sci-fi cyberpunk story. And these movies tend to not do well unless they've got the Matrix in the title. I mean, look at stuff like Johnny Mnemonic or Free Jack, Hardware, Strange Days, or even that RoboCop remake they made a couple years ago. These types of cyborg cyberpunk movies tend to not do well. So, no, Ghost in the Shell just didn't connect with an audience that had nothing to do with people being offended and up in arms over a whitewashing casting of Scarlett Johansson. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Two trailers I want to highlight for summer releases. The first one is War for the Planet of the Apes. It opens on July 14th.
There are times when it is necessary to abandon our humanity to save humanity.
They must pay. I will finish this. I offered you peace. I showed you mercy.
You talk about mercy?
No matter what you say, eventually you'd replace us. That's the law of nature.
Anyone who knows me knows that I do these little movie marathons with my kids where we sit down and we watch all of an entire series. In fact, I told my son, my youngest, who he wasn't old enough to kind of sit through all the movies when I showed all the Star Wars movies to my older kids. So we're going to do that again this summer and go through all eight current Star Wars movies, getting ready to go see The Last Jedi when it comes out at Christmas. But one of the marathons I did with my kids was an Apeathon a couple of years ago, and we watched all the Planet of the Apes movies, all the way going back to 1968 one with Charlton Heston, you know, the old, get your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape. So, you know, we did a damn dirty Apeathon a couple of years ago, and I finally watched all of them in order. And the first one's quite good. I mean, it's a classic. And the second one's okay. And the third one, Escape from Planet of the Apes, is okay. And then the next one, which I believe is Battle for Planet of the Apes, that one goes back in time and it shows the ape uprising, which is actually a lot of that was used for Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And so that one was good. And then the next one after that was garbage. Then they rebooted it and Rise of the Planet of the Apes, I loved. I thought it was a fantastic movie. And then when they did Dawn of the Planet of the Apes a couple of years ago, that one I thought was good enough. It had that sort of dirty human running around in the woods, post-apocalyptic feel to it, which I get bored with in movies a lot. And it looks like we have a lot of that going on in this one, but I'll tell you, it looks like there's a greater conflict happening in this film than what we had in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Because even though Caesar was the head of the apes, he wasn't the war leader that he becomes in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And so now he's kind of in full war mode in this one, obviously, by the title. So I'm looking forward to War with the Planet of the Apes. Again, we got a couple more years of technology, a couple more years of special effects, and it looks like there's a really good bad guy, Woody Harrelson. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm curious to see what they do, and I'm cautiously optimistic about this one. The next one I want to talk about is Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets, which opens on July 21st.
Welcome to Alpha, the City of 1,000 Planets, where for hundreds of years, every species has shared their knowledge and their intelligence with each other. After centuries of peace and prosperity, an unknown force wants to destroy all we have created.
Agents Valerian and Laureline, you have less than 10 hours to find the threat and eliminate it.
This is directed by Luc Besson, who is best known for doing movies like The Fifth Element, and he did the Taken movies, at least the first couple ones. And he does a lot of different stuff. He did like stuff like Arthur and the Invisibles. He's done everything from fantasy to action to sci-fi. And so he's and I respect him as a director. Even though I don't like all of his movies, I think he does some pretty impressive stuff. This is based on a graphic novel. It has a real sort of Fifth Element meets Ender's Game sort of feel to it. It does have that bubblegum pop look that Luc Besson gives in his movies like Fifth Element. So we'll see. We're not given much of a story in acting. It just is sort of meant to look visionary. And this trailer certainly does that. But I who knows? It might be good. It has potential. And Luc Besson has surprised me before. So I'm kind of looking forward to see what he does. That opens on July 21st. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Aftermath and Queen of the Desert. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The first film I want to talk about in this review segment is Aftermath. It's a smaller film and it's opening limited. The biggest reason it hit my radar in the first place is because it stars Arnold Schwarzenegger. It reminds me a little bit of that movie Maggie he did a couple years ago with it was sort of a pseudo-zombie story with Abigail Breslin, where it was a much more smaller, intimate movie. I think he's realized he can't do the big budget action movies. I mean, we proved that. I think people are done with him doing Terminator movies a couple years ago. And yeah, he did the Expendables, but other movies where he had stuff like, what was that? Escape Plan, which I quite liked, or like Sabotage, which I didn't. But Schwarzenegger's, his days are making the $100 million action movie, I think, are over. And he's trying some interesting stuff with smaller, intimate films. And this one is one of them. When his wife and pregnant daughter are killed in a mid-air plane collision, a man seeks to confront the air traffic controller who was on duty during the event.
The airplane that your wife and daughter were traveling in has had a very unfortunate accident. It is the worst news.
The company agrees to pay you damages in the amount of $75,000 for your daughter's death, $85,000 for your wife's.
Look at this photo. I would like for someone to say that they're sorry for killing my family. I just want to look him in the eye. I want him to apologize. No one has said they're sorry.
The first thing that actually caught my eye about this movie when I started watching it is it was actually filmed in Columbus, Ohio, which is my hometown. I live there. I guess I maybe had heard some buzz that there was something being filmed with Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger has a connection to Columbus because we have the Arnold Schwarzenegger Fitness Classic that takes place every year in downtown Columbus at the convention center, and the fitness experts from all over, and including Schwarzenegger, comes out for the keynote. And so it's a big deal. And I'm assuming that's what kind of brought him and this movie to the Buckeye State. But what I found interesting is so many times you see movies and they're like, oh, we made New York a character, LA a character. And that's garbage because New York and LA are in like, oh, you know, half the movies that are made, you know, so it's nothing special to see those cities in film, but it was neat to see my city in film, and they actually took advantage of the city. Like, there's a scene where the former mayor, Mike Coleman, has a cameo in the beginning. He literally runs into Schwarzenegger, and they shoot stuff at Columbus Airport, with the John Glenn International Airport, and they shoot stuff downtown, and you see, like, the Levesque Tower. So you see some stuff that's recognizable, and you hear news personalities and see logos that are recognizable to local people. So for me, it was kind of a thrill to watch that. But then, on top of it, it's an interesting movie because it says it's inspired by true events. And I went and I looked up finally after watching the movie, I looked up the events that actually this was based on, even though the actual character is a Russian and it was a Swiss air traffic controller who was in charge of it. So it took place in another country. A lot of the sort of like the beats, the focus points were similar. And it actually has, you know, even though it takes place in Columbus, Ohio, most of it, it tells the story of what happened over in Europe. I think it was in 2003 when this incident really first happened. Overall, it's not a bad movie. When you watch the trailer, you worry that they're going to take forever dragging out what the story is. You worry that you're going to take like an hour to get to the plane crash. But no, they start off with that. So, you know, knowing what the movie's about doesn't spoil anything for you. And what it really is it's this guy trying to recover from such a devastating thing. His wife and his only daughter get killed in a plane crash, and his daughter was pregnant. I mean, he lost everything all at once, and how do you handle that? And then they also show it from the perspective of the air traffic controller, played by Scoot McNairy. And he does a great job acting, because it shows how he was traumatized by the event. Because, I mean, it was essentially, it wasn't him drunk on the job. It wasn't him, you know, goofing off. I mean, it was stuff that had happened, and it was just this weird string of coincidences that happened that led to this midair collision. And Scoot McNairy really emotes. He shows the trauma and the struggle that this person has, and him trying to deal with the guilt that he blames himself for the death of hundreds of people. And, you know, and then of course there's the terror of any sort of, you midair collision, you're not going to walk away from that, because you don't have parachutes on a plane. Usually when a plane goes down, you know, hopefully it can make some sort of emergency landing or hit water where people can get out and have a chance to survive. Not at all for this. This kaput in the middle of the air. I mean, it would go crashing thousands of feet. You know, there was no way anyone was going to survive that. And I really think that Schwarzenegger does okay job acting. He's not a great actor, but I mean, he's trying. And that's why it reminds me a bit of Maggie. But Scoot McNairy is the one who really shows some chops in this film. And that's actually what carries it through, because it's a movie about grief and trauma and recovering from it from two different perspectives. So I'm going to actually have to say Aftermath, I quite liked. I'm going to say it kind of rocked.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Queen of the Desert. Nicole Kidman stars in Werner Herzog's epic look at Gertrude Bell's work in the Middle East.
Every step in the desert, life and fire claim me.
This little venture of yours is dangerous. A woman alone venturing out in the desert in times of war.
The Jews will take you for a spy.
I am a spy for no one but myself.
A woman passes through the entrance at the woman's sight.
This woman is joining the men. Paradise has no time. It awaits us.
One of the reasons why I pursued getting a screener for this one, I didn't see this in the theater, which I imagine it would probably play pretty well in the theater, because it takes place in Arabia, in Persia, during pre-World War One. You know, sort of like, and there's actually Lawrence from Lawrence of Arabia, played by Robert Pattinson, has a bit of a part in there. He swerves into the story. Now, he's a very young man. It's before he does what Lawrence of Arabia becomes known for. But it comes from that era, especially early in that era. And, you know, it tries in its own right to be that Lawrence of Arabia, the long shots and the, you know, wide vistas of the desert and camels walking across with the sun in the background. So there's a certain degree of imagery that's very, very beautiful. As they shoot in Petra, Jordan. And so it's gorgeous looking, and I saw it on a screener online, so it was low res and the color wasn't as rich as it probably could be. I imagine seeing it in the theater, it would look really good on the big screen. But beyond the look of the film, one of the reasons that I pursued it is because, well, you had Nicole Kidman, which was a pretty big name, but it was a Werner Herzog movie, and I haven't seen his full filmography. I've seen a handful of his movies. But I know he's probably one of the most well-respected directors living today, and so I said, let me see what he does. And you know, look, I'm not here to say not to respect Werner Herzog as a director, because I'm sure he has some brilliant movies out there. This is not one of them, sadly. And as gorgeous as this movie looks, and as much as this movie calls to be seen on the large screen and see it in its full format, it's just boring. You know, I mean, and I talk about political correctness earlier in this show and how people shouldn't be offended. But I don't care. Offend me. If you want to offend me, offend me. I can take it. Just don't bore me. This movie. I mean, maybe if I was at all interested in Gertrude Bell, I don't know much about her. At a certain point, the movie does kind of just feel like it's just being this series of, we're going to have these moments where she stands up to sexism, and it's just one after another, and it just gets boring. It's sort of like they're ready to awkwardly fit a line that she's purported to have said into the script.
She just wanders the desert and does things and takes a bath at one point, and there's a love story-ish thing with two different guys. It's so dull. So as much as I respect
the movie. And as much as I respect Nicole Kidman as an actor, and as much as I respect Werner Herzog, I gotta say, Queen of the Desert sucked, mainly because it bored the living bejeebus out of me.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about two movies that weren't boring, Smurfs The Lost Village and Going in Style. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Next film up on the docket is Smurfs, The Lost Village. Smurfette suspects there's another group of Smurfs in the forest and goes on a mission to find this lost village.
2 days ago, I saw someone who looked like us.
That's impossible.
And they dropped this map. If there really are other Smurfs out there, we need to find them.
What if this means the lost village isn't a legend?
Whoa. Now you're talking about maps and mystery Smurfs.
I didn't think the Lost Village was going to be this hard to find.
Is this safe?
We're not in Smurf Village anymore.
Wow, 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 wow.
The Lost Smurf Village.
It's interesting the trajectory these Smurf movies have taken. The first one came out, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. And it was actually a pretty big hit, a sizable hit. And it was not really good. Part of the reason I didn't like it was... the movie starts in the Smurfs village and then it busts out into New York City. And then it's them dealing with the craziness of being in New York. And they run into Neil Patrick Harris and Jemma Mays, who are these characters. And Gargamel comes out as a real person, tries to stop him. And it just seems so overly kitschy and very cookie cutter. And then when they did the sequel, they kind of did the same thing. They just carried that into the next movie where I guess they're in France. And I mean, the Smurfs were doing stuff, but it was all within the real world. So it was these little CGI characters inserted into a live action movie. And that always bothered me because I grew up watching the Smurfs. I remember when they really kind of made it big in America, at least with their cartoon, was in the early 80s. And I remember watching the TV show on Saturday mornings and after school. And it's not great. And I remember when that came out, I got a couple of the DVDs for my kids and I went back and watched them, and they're crappy little 80s animation, which has a certain charm for the nostalgia of the day. But I would never call the Smurfs great animation. I mean, they weren't even classic animation like Tom and Jerry cartoons or Looney Tunes or Popeye or Oswald the Rabbit. You know, nothing like that. These were just crummy, churn them out 80s cartoons. But, you know, for somebody who grew up in the 80s, they're kind of cool. And what annoyed me about these first two movies is that they have a certain bit in the Smurfs doing the Smurf adventures, and then they bust out into the real world, and it ceases to become a Smurf cartoon and more of a Neil Patrick Harris and Jemma Mays vehicle with some Smurfs attached to it. It reminded me a lot of what happened with the Muppets about the same time, you know, 2011 or something like that. And it really wasn't a Muppet movie. It was a movie about Jason Segel and Amy Adams, and the Muppets were along for the ride. And I'm like, no, give me a movie about the Muppets. And then when they did Muppets Most Wanted, it didn't do as well. I have always been saying I would like to see a genuine Smurfs movie. And that's what this is. This is an actual full-blown, all-in-the-Smurfs universe Smurf movie. They don't go into the real world. They don't encounter live-action people. It's a story about Smurfs on an adventure being chased by Gargamel and Azrael the cat trying to capture them. And honestly, that was a huge win on my part. Like I said, somebody who grew up with the Smurfs and somebody who grew up knowing who Smurfette was, and that Smurfette was created by Gargamel, formed in clay so she could then sneak into the Smurfs village. I mean, I remember that episode. I remember watching that episode as a kid. I remember when I watched Donnie Darko and they make a point to talk about that in the movie Donnie Darko. I was like, yes, he's right, created by Gargamel. She's not a real Smurf. I thought it was a neat idea. And so the fact that they're calling back to that and fully integrating it into the mythology of the show, I was into it. And then there's a little bit more smart humor here. There's like things that, I mean, it's not at the level like The Boss's Baby had some real subversive stuff that adults are going to get and kids aren't going to get. And you see that a lot in DreamWorks and Pixar stuff. They didn't have that, but they had some very funny lines and some clever things. And they just didn't rely on being loud and obnoxious every time they wanted to have a funny gag, which is sort of like what they did with the Angry Birds movie. But, you know, I have to say, I kind of enjoyed it. It takes them on an adventure. It reminds me a little bit of Trolls, but I thought it was better than Trolls. And it's weirdly a female empowerment movie of Smurfs without, like, being aggressively obnoxious about it. I mean, it's about Smurfette, and it really is Smurfette's journey. And I'm okay with that. I think she's actually one of the most interesting characters because she has the most complex backstory of any of the Smurfs. But I even had to wake up on a Saturday morning to go see it. Took my son. He enjoyed it. We went and got fast food afterwards. It was a fun little dad and kid date, but it was neat to see the Smurfs. And the only thing that they did, there's a Meghan Trainor song in there. And before the movie, before they showed it, we got there like half hour before it started. And they were basically playing this 1 minute video of her singing the song on loop. So after you listen to the Meghan Trainor song for like 30 times, that's enough to make any parent go insane. But I still ended up enjoying the movie, and the animation's really cool, and it's bright and colorful, and I think kids are going to like it, and diehard Smurf fans are going to like it. I don't know if it's going to get any new supporters, but hopefully it'll do better than the last movie. But that's it. I'm going to have to say that the Smurfs kind of rocked.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Going in Style. Three retirees see their pensions exploited and decide to rob the bank and charge for recompense.
Williamsburg Savings will manage the liquidation of the fund.
These banks practically destroyed this country, and nothing ever happened to them.
I want to rob that bank.
Let's go get our money back.
Yeah.
We pick exactly what's on the pension, right?
That's all I want.
What if we get more?
We give it to charity.
We're gonna need professional help.
You think?
You 5-0?
We're practically 8-0.
Here's another one that takes us back to the early 80s. Well, actually, I think the original was made in 1979 for Going in Style, and it starred Art Carney and George Burns and, oh, I forget the other guy who's in it, but it was three old guys. So now they've got people who are relatively young back when that movie was made are making this movie. So you've got Morgan Freeman, you've got Alan Arkin, and you've got Michael Caine, which is neat in itself because Morgan Freeman and Michael Caine both were in the Batman movies by Christopher Nolan. So you've got Lucius Fox and Alfred working together to steal pension money from a bank. It's directed by Zach Braff. And I have to say, I kind of went through this weird flux leading up to seeing this film, because on one hand I heard Going in Style, I'm like, oh, I remember hearing about that movie. I never saw it. My sister saw it. All I knew about Going in Style was that somebody wets his pants in the movie. Somebody wets her pants in this movie too, so maybe it's the same character. But I remember my sister liked the movie, and it was a fun comedy. So I've never seen the original, but this one kind of looked interesting, and I said, oh, I'm curious to see it. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, look at the actors. I like Michael Caine. I like Alan Arkin. I like Morgan Freeman. That's great. I was excited to see it. Then I saw it was directed by Zach Braff, and, you know, my brain took a screeching halt. Not a big fan of Zach Braff. Oh, I loved Scrubs, but I'm not a big fan of Zach Braff. I have not really liked his movies. He did that awful movie, Garden State, which apparently got a lot of great reviews and people love it, but I think it was absolute garbage. And then he acted in a couple things, and he ended up in making a movie a couple years ago. He got a Kickstarter campaign to fund it. He made Wish You Were Here or Wish I Was There or something like that. And wow, that movie was terrible. It was attempting to be a Garden State for a guy who has kids now. Coming of age for a father dealing with his children. I remember struggling to get through it. I struggled to get through that movie. And that kind of went nowhere, rightfully so. What I find interesting about this is he said, finally, I think this was a good choice. And a lot of actors do this where they say, you know what, I'm not going to star in the movie. I'm going to let myself take a break. I'm just going to direct. Because I do not think Zach Braff is a triple threat. And so he's doing Going in Style. He never shows up in the film unless it's like a weird cameo that I didn't recognize him. So the fact that he was off screen allowed him to make a less Zach Braffy kind of movie. I think it allowed him to make a movie that didn't feel like he was trying to recreate Garden State. And, you know, it's not a great story. It's not a great script, but you have this really good cast, these three old guys, and they make it work. And it's just kind of a joy to see these three play off each other, even if they don't have the greatest lines. And I don't know if that's just brilliance in Zach Braff's directing or if it's just these guys are great on screen and just work out well together. But overall, I mean, I thought Going in Style was a lot of fun. It has a somewhat a generic soundtrack for this kind of movie, and it has a generic pacing, and, you know, it's a heist film in, at its heart, but it works. And it's not Ocean's 11, but it's not trying to be. It's just trying to be a little bit of a coming of age movie for these old guys. And them having a little bit of fun with a whimsical attempt to rob a bank. So I'm going to have to say Going in Style impressed me. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be reviewing The Void. And then I'll be talking about the weekly box office and the home cinema roundup featuring a look at Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Void. This is a horror movie, and it's got a lot of acclaim. It's gotten a lot of buzz, and it's opening in limited release this week. So for fans of horror, you know, I like to track some of that stuff, especially the more fringe stuff. This is one that is probably on your radar. A group of people are trapped in a hospital with a mysterious murder cult outside and an unthinkable creature inside hunting them.
Haven't you ever wished to save someone beyond saving?
The body has to adjust, of course.
We weren't built for this kind of thing. You'd be surprised at the things you find when you go looking.
There is something calling them all here.
You saw it? What was that?
Do you know where you go when you die? I do.
Essentially, the gist of the story is that this deputy sheriff finds this guy on the side of the road and takes him to the hospital, and then there are these people chasing him, and he goes into the hospital, which is it's being shut down because there was a fire there, and it's kind of on a skeleton crew, and he brings him into the emergency room, and then this murder cult shows up outside and sort of traps him in the hospital. And at the same time, there's something happening to the people. They're going insane and morphing into these strange creatures. And it deals with paranoia. There's certainly an attempt to try and recreate the paranoia and thrills and terror of John Carpenter's The Thing. It doesn't come close to that. So, I mean, you can totally see the influence of John Carpenter's The Thing on this film. It doesn't quite hit the mark 100% all the time with that, but it certainly allows it to do some creepy moments. You also see some influence of Hellraiser, and you see just sort of like the influence of something like Dawn of the Dead, where people are trapped in a location fighting people that are possibly outside trying to kill them. So it's clear that the directors and writers have a history with horror and have either watched it or dealt with it, or at least wanting to emulate certain things that have been done in the past. And I'd say about 75% of the time, what they do is effective. One of my biggest problems with this movie, it's sort of like it's the Lost syndrome. If you ever watched the show Lost, it started in back in what, like 2003, 2004. And it takes like a whole season to find out who's does what on the island. Whereas I'm like, I remember saying to my wife when we watched it, I'm like, gosh, you know, if I was a survivor from a crash, once we got everything cleaned up, I'd line everybody up. I said, okay, get me a manifest. Okay, we need to know anybody here. Anyone a farmer? Anyone a nutritionist? Anyone a doctor? Anybody a survivalist? Anyone an Eagle Scout? Suddenly you're going to want to start to break down who is an asset on the island and what people's skills were so you can use them to survive. And they never do that in Lost. And I know why they do that. It's so they could drag it out over a couple seasons. But that doesn't feel realistic. And that's kind of what happens here. You get these people all stuck in this hospital, and then these people come in with guns and they're ready to shoot everybody. And they're apparently being chased by the murder cult. But at no point does anyone look at somebody else and say, what's going on? Why are you coming in here with guns? Why are you chasing us? Why are you chasing that? But just explain yourself. Just so it's all out in the open. Nobody ever even asks. Mainly because there's no reason for them not to tell them. It's a cheap plot device to kind of keep the viewer uninformed so it's more of a mystery. But it at times just gets in the way because at some point you'd at least ask people what happened right before you got here kind of thing. Once you get past that, it works as sort of a group of people trapped in a situation where there's something dangerous inside and outside. And, you know, that sort of had that with the movie Life a couple weeks ago. The danger inside was the hostile alien. The danger outside was the vacuum and coldness of space. And the greatest strength of this movie is what starts out as seems to be a run-of-the-mill, almost hostage situation. It gets rather creative and it does some neat things. I'm not going to go into what it is, but it really goes off the rails in a very good way. And it ends much, much, much stronger than it begins. And I'd say the last half is twice the movie that the first half is. And that's good. If you're going to make a one half of your movie better than the other, it's best to make the last half better so that that's what you're left with remembering. And ultimately, when the grisly things happen, when the violence starts happening, it's relevant, it's necessary, and it's scary, and it's disturbing. And that's what makes a good horror movie. So The Void's not perfect, but it's definitely worth checking out, especially if you're a horror fan. So The Void kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the box office really quick. Last week, I said that Beauty and the Beast was going to win with $45 million. I'm happy to say I was wrong. While Beauty and the Beast did make $45 million, my $35 to $40 million prediction for The Boss Baby was way off. It made over $50 million. In its opening weekend, beating Beauty and the Beast, which is great because I really like The Boss Baby. I think the thing that worked with The Boss Baby is there's a lot of people who I went to it either out of curiosity or out of necessity because their kids wanted to go see it and ended up liking it. And then it got some good word of mouth and it had a good start and it just expanded over the weekend, which is the sign of a good movie and unexpected surprise. And everybody I've talked to has been like, yeah, I was surprised at how much I enjoyed that movie. Ghost in the Shell made just under $19 million, which actually for a movie like that is right on target. For a cyberpunk, cyborg, futuristic cop movie, right around $20 million is what you'd expect. I know they were hoping they would get a Lucy bump. What happened with Lucy when Scarlett Johansson did that with Luc Besson, who we talked about earlier, you weren't going to get that because Lucy's a much more accessible movie than The Ghost in the Shell ever was going to be. So, you know, do I look at this $19 million? Yeah, if you spend $110 million on the movie, that's a low box office number, but that to me is not a big surprise. And in fact, I wasn't expecting Ghost in the Shell to do super well. I would have loved to have seen it do well because I kind of liked it. But, you know, just under $20 million, that's what you'd expect for a movie like this. So let's not read too much into it. Then The Zookeeper Wife in a much smaller release came in number 10 at $3.3 million, and it's expanding to like 800 and some cinemas this week. Now, this week, I think that it's going to be a horse race. You're going to see a horse race between Beauty and the Beast, Boss Baby, and the Smurfs. Tracking for Smurfs, people are saying under 20. I wouldn't be surprised if it did a little bit better. The biggest struggle that Smurfs going to have is taking the audience away from the Boss Baby, because that's pretty much the same audience, kids and families. Right now, if you look at those three movies, if they top in 1, 2, and 3, those are three essentially kids movies. You know, this is a family movie weekend, which, you know, it works leading, you know, into the week before Easter. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The movie of the week, the one that finally hit Blu-ray and DVD. It's been out on demand for a couple weeks, but I always like to cover these movies when they hit on DVD and Blu-ray because, you know, it's a home cinema thing. I like to have a physical copy of the disc myself. And then we can talk about the special features because overall, the movie itself is there, but there's also some extra stuff in there. Let's just play the trailer for the Blu-ray.
We need to capture the Death Star plans if there's any hope of destroying it. Time to fight is now!
Load it up. I never ever thought that I'd be lucky enough to be directing a Star Wars movie.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Now, of course, you got the movie, and the movie's fantastic. I really enjoyed the movie. I thought Gareth Edwards completely redeemed himself from Godzilla, which was kind of a bust, And I think he's great with characters and doing something a little bit alternative, but Lucasfilm and Disney kept him in line actually making a Star Wars movie instead of just making a movie that is sort of the anti-Star Wars movie. It was different enough of a story that it wasn't just rehashing the original series. So it gave Garth Edwards a chance to do anti-Star Wars while still making a bona fide Star Wars movie. The other thing I found that was amazing, aside from, you know, just the characters and the acting and the special effects, I love the fact that the production design and costume design felt like it was from the 1970s. It felt like it could completely lead into A New Hope. And it's funny, when we watched it as a family at home, my wife looks at us and she's like, let's watch the original Star Wars now. And I'm like, yeah, it's midnight. You're going to fall asleep. And she's like, oh, you're right. And so we didn't watch it. But this summer, I'm going to watch all the movies in the order in which they take place in the universe with my youngest son, who's never seen all of them. Well, he's seen all of them, but not like in a row like that. So we're going to make a weekend out of it. But the other thing I want to point out is if you get the Blu-ray, not only do you get, it comes on two discs, well, three, because there's a DVD of it, which doesn't have any features on that Blu-ray, but there's an entire second Blu-ray disc that has over an hour of features on it. It's basically an hour-long documentary broken into several parts, talking about just kind of where the idea comes from and then the different characters and how they put together the Empire and how they go for the look and how they do all this, the motion capture, so they could get the appearance of Peter Cushing and a young Carrie Fisher in the film. And that's what's so neat about it. And then there's also a little feature that gives you some of the Easter eggs, features and surprises that you can find in the movie. That cross-link to other Star Wars films. So overall, I mean, Rogue One's a lot of fun, and the Blu-ray rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And then just real quick, the other two releases I want to highlight. We've got Office Christmas Party, which seems odd to come out in April. And then Patterson, of course, starring Adam Driver as a bus driver from New Jersey. That is it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about the big summer kickoff a couple weeks early with The Fate of the Furious. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.